I'm Ed Stetzer. Welcome to another edition of The Exchange. We're excited to be able to have a conversation, exchange of ideas around mission, around church, and today kind of an unusual conversation. We're going to talk some about politics and ultimately working together for the common good. It's unusual because usually we're talking to pastors and church leaders about outreach or evangelism or culture. And so, but I think this is, right now we increasingly find ourselves in a cultural conversation about what's the role of faith in the public square. Is it a naked public square? We'll explain that later. Sounds worse than it is. Is it a naked public square? Is there a faith component in the midst of this? Where do evangelicals, most of the viewers here will be evangelicals, where do evangelicals fit into this conversation as well? And what's unique to the American context, it's not found around the world, is that there are statistical correlations actually to religiosity, technical term, and political affiliation. That's not the case in most of the world, in most of the Western world. In Australia, that's not the case, for example. I've just returned from there. But here's a statistical reality that gets some people mad. I get letters and complaints when I say this, but here's the statistical reality. The more you go to church, the more likely you are statistically to be a Republican. The less you go to church, the more likely you are statistically to be a Democrat. This is not saying that there are no Democrats who are Christians and all Republicans are Christians by any stretch of the imagination. That is a statistical reality that everybody in both campaigns acknowledge. It's called the God gap, is what it's often called. And this is unique in the Western world, where we have major parties that are now leading to this division. And also, at the same time, what's happening is, particularly as for evangelicals, most of the viewers here will be evangelicals, is the values of the broader culture are becoming more progressive, whereas evangelical values, a recent poll was recently released by the HRC, and one of the things they actually called evangelicals resistors. And evangelicals, conservative Catholics, and Mormons are not shifting. I mean, very small percentage. It's a bit of a myth that there's a huge shift. But they're not shifting on certain issues, whereas the population as a whole is clearly shifting on the population as a whole. So it puts in a different place. The way I've often described it is that what was once evangelicalism, wouldn't be called this 100 years ago, has largely lost its home field advantage. We live in a different kind of world, a different kind of context, a place where pluralism and progressive values are more evident. And so the question then becomes, how then should we live? How then shall we live? And so that's what we're going to talk about today. And we're going to have a very different kind of conversation. And the reason is, I'm going to introduce my guests when we come back from the break. My guests actually represent believers from who both love the Lord, but who are involved and engaged in the political conversation, perhaps from different perspectives. Friends, but perhaps from different perspectives. Because what we're finding now is an increasing interest, the Democratic Party and the Obama faith people, and that I'll explain more of that later on, intentionally and strategically reached out to evangelicals. So if you watched the campaign, you saw, for example, Donald Miller in the first campaign. There's some debate about whether or not those numbers shifted a lot. The Dallas Morning News did analysis, said no, others said yes. We'll talk some about that. But there is a question of, is the monolithic connection of evangelicalism to republicanism good? That's one question. Is it staying? That's another question among subsequent generations. And thirdly, is it ultimately need to be separated anyway? And we're going to talk about that. We're going to dive into that, which I think will be a fascinating conversation. So don't run away if you think, well, I don't want to talk about politics, because it's not going to be mainly a political discussion, but ultimately we're going to point to how can we work together for the common good in the new world in which we find ourselves. And by the way, I don't think it's done. I think the culture is shifting. It's not shifted. And we're going to talk some about what that future looks like. You're a pastor, you're a church leader. You'll want to be a part of this conversation, and this, I think, will be helpful and instrumental. I want to encourage you to have an open mind. Because sometimes people think, well, there's a Christian political view. I get that there are Christian issues that are more foundational and determined. I don't think, for example, there's a biblical position on the marginal tax rates, though some Christians on their little voter guides seem to think that there are. And so we're going to talk some about what is biblical issue, what's a Christian issue, and how do we live in a world that doesn't hold the same values sometimes that we, as the evangelical resistors, and also many of you, of course, mainline Protestants and beyond. So I think it'll be a fascinating conversation. So stay with us. We'll be back after a quick break, and then we'll start this conversation. I'll introduce my guest then. We'll be right back on The Exchange.
People are searching for something. They don't always know it's God they're looking for. They seem to look for him in the wrong places. God says people will find him when they search for him with all their heart. That sounds easy, but it's not. I think churches are supposed to help people find God. But I wonder if some churches have stopped helping. Some people know where God is, but they keep running from him. Maybe they'll bump into him by accident. If they do, I don't think it was an accident. God says he's come to give you a big life. We should help people remember that.
Hey, I'm Ed Stetzer, and welcome back to The Exchange. It's time to introduce my fascinating guests. And on the right, ironically, is Michael Ware. And you are, right now, you're an independent consultant. You are co-founder of the Values Partnership, basically connecting organizations, common good, public good, which is a big part we want to end our show today. What you're probably best known for, though, is you were the White House faith-based initiative during President Obama's first term. You led the evangelical outreach. And that's where we connected first. We were at the same meeting at RNA.
That's right.
And Religion News Writers Association, yep. Which was a fascinating meeting for a lot of other reasons. There was a lot of crazy in that meeting. not from the guests, but from some of the speakers. And you helped manage the White House's engagement on religious and values issues. You're one of the youngest White House staffers in modern American history, and there's a lot of young staffers. You serve on the National Board of Bethany Christian Services. We shared a concern about some of the recent kind of attacks on adoption, and we're encouraged to see some pushback on that. Writes for The Atlantic, Relevant, other publications. You and Melissa are Buffalo New Yorkers.
That's right.
And lived there 7 years, so love New York. I'm a New Yorker, but also in Buffalo. You now live in Chevy Chase, Maryland. You can follow him at Twitter at Michael R. Ware, and that'll be on the screen, and michaelware.com. We're glad you're here. Thanks for coming.
Good to be here.
And of course, we have next to me Dan Darling. And Ware and Darling, everyone's last name has a meaning other than mine. Stetzer means nothing. You're everyone's darling. You're the vice president of for communications of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. Mm-hmm. Ethics, Religious Liberty. I mean, they're kind of descriptive of what it is. You're a pastor in Chicago. That's how we knew one another in the internet world, author of several books, including Teen People, the Bible, Crash Course, iFaith, Real, and your latest, and the one we'll put up on the screen here, is Activist Faith, which is going to relate to some of what our conversation is about. You're a regular contributor to, it says Out of Urban, it's Parse now. You write for Leadership Parse, Journal occasionally, and just all over the different places, a lot of evangelical publications, op-eds in CNN and Washington Post. Went to Dayspring Bible College, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and you live now in Nashville. DanielDarling.com is where people can find an at Dan Darling. Okay, so let's start a conversation here because you know, the people who watch are going to be primarily evangelicals. Yeah. And evangelicals, you know, and I'd be interested to know from your perspective, did the faith campaign move the evangelical numbers? Because you know that whole debate and on that. And ultimately, I mean, talk to us a little about what was the challenge of representing the Obama administration, where I don't think it's a secret. Evangelicals overwhelmingly didn't vote for. You tried to move the needle, like to know if you did. But then how did you do that as an evangelical in that White House? Talk to us about that.
So a few things. First, electorally, first it's important, as folks should be aware, 2008 was a vastly different campaign
Very
than
different.
2012.
Right.
2008 was aspirational.
Right.
2008 was about open possibilities. 2012 was about the base. 2012 was about protecting an administration that was an incumbent president.
Yeah.
So just tonally, and in terms of the culture of the campaign, it was very different, both internally and externally. We saw the needle move, especially in 2008, over Kerry numbers, for instance, which was really...
But Kerry numbers were pretty dismal.
That was the low point of sort of Democratic faith, faith outreach. And so nationally, we saw numbers among evangelicals go up. I think more specifically because of the classic Obama ground game and all of that, what we saw were in states, especially around the Rust Belt, evangelicals in Ohio, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, we saw double-digit increases. In Colorado,
so you don't need the national shift.
That's right.
But you get
Ohio. About the Electoral College.
Yeah, you get Ohio.
Because you're only running in a presidential campaign, you're only running a full ground operations in 11, 12, maybe 18 states. As far as my work in the White House, my job was to help bring evangelicals to the table on issues of common cause, but most importantly, I think, was to make sure that evangelicals and other aspects of the faith community had a voice in the decisions that were taking place. So sometimes their voice didn't carry the day, but I think one thing that we were able to do was to make sure as conversations were going on about immigration, about the HHS mandate, about the full array of issues that thoughtful, faithful evangelicals from across the spectrum were able to at least be heard. Mm-hmm. And I think we were able to do that in a way where it wasn't just sort of political religious organizations, but we brought pastors to the table and frontline operators, the Bethany Christian Services of the world. And so that's a big part of what I tried to do.
Interesting. Now I remember when in the second campaign,
I
contacted, I think it was you, and I said, who would be a good person? I'd interview on the blog.
Yeah.
And from the Democratic side, and I had guests do that. But what I found is, you wouldn't be surprised, is that my audience is primarily evangelical. My blog's at Christianity Today. Is that the fact that I had a Republican and a Democrat was stunning to people.
Yeah.
And even though I asked questions that were not without challenge to the person. There is a substantial percentage. I don't know if it's a majority. I think evangelical leaders sort of knew you and appreciated, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a substantial number of evangelicals like, what in the world are you doing promoting that agenda?
Yeah.
And so, you have the evangelical credentials. People don't necessarily know, but they wouldn't. You're at the chapel in Buffalo, New York. We have the Buffalo connection.
Yeah.
You attend National Community Church. Assemblies of God Church there in outside of D.C. I guess it's not outside. It's in D.C.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And
in
so I mean, how do you answer the how are you representing some of these things to some areas where this is maybe a minority, but a vocal minority that just can't imagine that?
Well, what's important to note, right, and I think Dan would agree, and I think you would, neither party has the picture completely accurate. And so what I found is that we need faithful Christians investing in institutions. And what I tried to do, both in the White House and on the campaign, was lift up the aspects of the president's agenda that were being voiced from the president that maybe were not given as much voice on the other side. And what I tried to be, I sent an email out to pastors when I first decided to take the campaign job and asked them to hold me accountable to never making the claim that Barack Obama was the candidate for people of faith or the candidate for evangelicals, because I don't believe that, and I ran Faith Outreach for his campaign. But I think as evangelicals, we have to be willing to look in a hopeful way, in a way that lacks sort of the cynicism that has blanketed so much of our culture at the options that we have. And I think if it's 70-30, which it was in 2008, probably 72-28 going from Mitt Romney, that's fine.
On evangelicals.
On evangelicals. Right.
Evangelicals were the only ones voting, right. Mitt Romney would be king.
That's right. that's absolutely right.
But you did and, move some.
That's yeah. right. So obviously my goal on the campaign was to get as many votes from as many different people as possible. But in the White House, I wasn't trying to rack up political support. I was trying to make sure that the evangelicals had a voice.
And I'm glad you're there. You know, I think, though I don't want you to confirm or deny, you know, when President Obama ran for senator at the time, he said that he was going to kind of end the practice of what at the time was called discrimination in hiring of people involved in the faith-based initiative.
Yeah.
In other words, if you receive federal funding, you can no longer say to somebody, you're not a Methodist or you're not a Pentecostal, you can't work for us. Which religious organizations said, this is just central. I mean, if we can't hire people according to our beliefs, then this is a problem.
No longer a religious organization.
Exactly. I mean, that's it. So candidate Obama said that, and then President Obama didn't do that.
That's right.
He got widely hammered from the left on this.
Yep.
Now, we're not going to ask of your relationship with this, but I have been told that you were part of that switch, and I think that's important and essential for us to see, the recognition and the value of those beliefs being at the table. So I'm glad you were there. Dan, you work for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, connected to Southern Baptist, mm-hmm. more conservative denomination, mm-hmm. some say very conservative denomination. And so, I mean, yet you've written about activist faith. Mm-hmm. You've actually strayed on some issues. Sometimes you write some things that surprise some people and get people riled up, like on gun control or things of that sort. And not to throw you under the bus. We won't gash all your beliefs on that. But how do you try to represent your faith in the political sphere where there's a significant percentage of Christians who, for example, is gun control or marginal tax rates or for example, is universal health care and providing access to it? Some people see those as actually Christian issues. Mm-hmm. In other words, I guess the UK and Australia, or the Australia with a growing economy and national health care, mm-hmm. Is somehow doing wrong. Because sometimes you hear Christians, and it's as if they make everything a Christian issue. How do you balance that as activist faith?
Well, I think what we have to be careful of as faithful Christians is, taking certain political issues or a party and baptizing them with Jesus, and so making Jesus the mascot for a party. It happens on the right and the left. I think there's certain core issues that if you're a faithful evangelical, that will naturally, you'll naturally be there. But I think at times, just because evangelicals are conservative, say on pro-life or on the marriage issue, religious liberty issue, sometimes we think, well, we're going to take the entire conservative movement on all these other things. And there's many issues that, the Bible just doesn't speak on. And so there's honest disagreement among friends, among Christians. And so certain things like the delivery of, we all care about the poor, right and left, but there's a significant disagreement about the best delivery method to help the poor and the size of government and where the line is on that and many other issues. So I think Christians, I think there's two mistakes. I think on the one hand, some Christians are so afraid of politics so they don't say anything. On the other hand, there's sort of the over-politicized thing where you're sort of baptizing God and country and there's no distinguishment. And then you don't have a love for the nations as Christ did. I think the middle ground is to say, I'm going to be faithful to the scriptures. I'm going to love my city. If you love your city, as Jeremiah told the exiles, to seek the welfare of your city,
that's right.
You can't do that without caring about the policies and the social structures that affect real people. So in America, we should steward our citizenship well and try to shape the cities to make it good for human flourishing and for those that that live in the cities.
Yeah, but it seems that you said, Michael, that about that no one party gets it right. But statistically, evangelicals mm-hmm. are Republicans. Most of our world viewers are Republicans, so it seems that the issues get entangled, maybe. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, if you're pro-life, you're also pro-death penalty, which is statistically a fascinating connection, but mm-hmm. it's true. Pro-life people tend to be higher pro-death penalty, or they also be higher pro-gun. And so, how do you disentangle what So I would say pro-life is an issue that is a faith, a Christian issue. Mm-hmm. So so how do you disentangle marginal tax rates from pro-life issue without losing, you know, because I mean, what it seems that evangelicals have kind of very influenced by maybe the right, have sort of tied these things together. So these are all Christian issues. Is there a way to disentangle them?
Well, I think most evangelicals say there's a hierarchy of issues, you know, and so for most evangelicals, the pro-life issue is central just because we're talking about the image of God and the unborn, and we're talking about championing those who can't speak for themselves. And so that takes preeminence. And many times, the politicians that at least say they're pro-life also hold these other conservative positions. Right. And so
you're not going to be elected to a Republican office, probably, unless you're pro-life, pro-gun, low taxes. Yeah. So it becomes a package.
Well, and every time you vote, you're voting for what you feel is the best of two sinners in a fallen world. That's you're right. never going to find an ideal candidate. Mm-hmm. And I think we really need to get away from thinking like this is the Christian candidate, you know, this is the one guy that's going to usher in the kingdom or something, mm-hmm. and realize, hey, we're being good stewards, we're voting for good leaders who are flawed, we're going to make the best decision in voting and then pray for them and really put our hope in Christ when he returns mm-hmm. to set up his kingdom. And his policy plank is perfect, you know, obviously. So I think that's the way we need to think through it.
Yeah, Jesus isn't coming back riding on a donkey or an elephant.
Exactly.
and I think that's important. But so when you think about some of these issues, how do you help people who see them? Now, this is the part I want to see this. How do you help people create a hierarchy of issues? Because it doesn't feel like they have a... When I look on social media, it doesn't feel that there's a hierarchy of issues on these. How do you help evangelicals think that way?
Well, I think you just have to think through what are the issues of the time mm-hmm. and the day. And again, pro-life, this is an issue that it seems like we're winning in the culture, but we have a lot of work to do.
I would say it's the only issue among kind of the evangelical mm-hmm. culture issues where the trends are going in a direction that would please evangelicals.
So I think it's okay to say this is a main issue for me. I want to vote this way. However, I would caution people, and I say this in my book, let's vote well. And let's steward that well. But let's not let that be the only pro-life activism we do. So in between the elections, while we're waiting for Roe versus Wade to be overturned or whatever law we want to be passed, let's be active in our communities and help advance the pro-life cause. So for instance, I really champion pro-life pregnancy centers that really do help young women in distress, help them make good decisions to carry their babies to term, but also walk with them after that and really... It's a missional ministry. And so we're saying to be pro-life is not just to be angry on Facebook every 4 years and you think, hey, I'm great, I'm pro-life. But it's to walk through with these people and apply the gospel.
And for the record, electing pro-life candidates has not moved the needle on the issue anyway.
Right.
So it is a bit tricky. But again, on pro-life, for example. All right, so one of the tweets that I tweet too much. And one of the tweets that I got some pushback from is during the DNC, I tweeted that because I think there were 24 occasions when choice was mentioned, mm-hmm. typically not the word abortion, but on those 24 occasions there was cheering every time. It was the most cheered single subject at the DNC, and so I shouldn't say that, I don't know for certain, but it was stunning, mm-hmm. and so how do evangelical Christians, people of faith, or Catholics and others, I mean, as someone who worked in that campaign, how would you answer? You know, at least President Clinton talked about being safe, legal, and rare. Yes. I don't know they did too much towards the rare, but we didn't even hear that language at the most recent time. It seems that that's just sort of lost. So how do we become co-laborers in reducing abortion?
Yeah. So the president has talked about reducing the number of abortions during his first 4 months in office. He went to Notre Dame, gave a speech, and I'll have to say, you know, it's interesting how siloed we get and how our political party affiliations sometimes prevent us from calling out the good and the other side. Yeah. And so when he gave a speech at Notre Dame, there were pro-life protesters instead of pro-life people saying, well, you got the core issue wrong, but we still think there's probably some ways that we could reduce mm-hmm. the number of abortions while we fight about the legality. Listen, it wasn't my job to convince pro-life Christians that Barack Obama is pro-life because he's not.
Right.
Mm-hmm. His from Saddleback to interview with Christianity Today,
right, sure,
to Notre Dame speech, the way he's addressed, the way he addressed this issue, and my role serving him was to serve him, to
right,
not advance.
Sure.
So
because that was not a cause that he was.
That's
but it did
right,
seem that at the beginning, it sort of there was you said first,
yeah,
4 months, but after the first 4 months,
yep,
the issue sort of went away.
Well, I'll tell you, we spent. I was part of a small group of folks that included very senior members of his administration that did meetings with over 100 groups invested in the issue. Now, that included Planned Parenthood.
Sure, sure.
Also included the Southern Baptists and National Association of Evangelicals. What we found is that neither side is too interested in finding common ground.
Really?
They really love fighting the legality battle. We've seen the president signed the adoption tax credit, made it permanent,
mm-hmm,
and so I think that's a pro-life issue. We saw the president increase maternal support, but again, sort of right to pro-life. Those are in some ways ancillary issues. But just to return to the core point I want to make is that it's encouraging to politicians, especially if you vote straight line Republican, if as a faithful Christian you can still find it to say, hey, I'm against you on 90% of what you said, but man, I think there's something maybe you don't even realize about you calling to reduce the number of abortions.
Mm-hmm.
And I affirm that, and I'd like to work with you on that. We could have seen more of that. I think that would have, if there would have been more of that from the pro-life community, I think maybe it wouldn't have been the first 4 months,
yeah,
or first 2 years.
Well, I'm disappointed, yeah, to hear that there wasn't that, because
yeah,
I think that's one area, if we're going to talk about, mm-hmm, working together for human flourishing,
yeah,
for the betterment,
yeah,
of society, that we want to live in. And again, the language was Clinton-esque, you know, safe, legal, and rare.
That's right.
But I wish, we may even disagree on safe and legal, but we all should be able to agree on rare.
That's right.
And so, okay, we're gonna continue this conversation,
yeah, yeah,
move more towards working towards the common, mm-hmm, good. When we come back, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back on the other side, let's continue our conversation. We'll be right back. We're back and glad you're here. We're not live. Well, we're live. The three of us are live, but you're watching not live. And so you can't tweet your questions as we normally do using the hashtag The Exchange. But these, we're pre-recording these during the Q conference here in Nashville. And so you can find these and all the interviews we do at edstetzer.com. Click on the Exchange link and be able to follow along. Lots of great interviews with great leaders and Christian thinkers and leaders. Okay, so we're talking about working towards the common good. And I would think, Dan, that the common good would include, for example, people having universal access or universal coverage related to healthcare. Yet that's become sort of a wedge issue. Matter of fact, it may be the wedge issue in the upcoming election.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we as Christians, and again, I'm not saying all Christians are Republicans or all Republicans are Christians, so please, you just slap me. If you think I said something wrong, you slap me. But I don't think that, but I always, whenever I say that, but because evangelicals are Republicans, evangelicals are those who are often opposed to the president's plan, which he's called and others called Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about that. So why would we not want to say, you know, this is something, a goal of every civilized society, we would have all the members of that society have access to healthcare?
Well, I think it should be a goal of every Christian. I mean, when you think of human flourishing, actually, you think of the sanctity of life. You should want everyone to have access to good health care. And it gets personal, too. I pastored for many years. And so you see the very real struggles that people have. And so I think where the disagreement is, what's the best delivery method? Mm-hmm. And so you have very good disagreements on the right and people saying, we want people to have access to good health care. We just don't think a government-run system, or perhaps this government-run system proposed by the president, is the best delivery system.
So I heard Republicans hate poor people and hate sick people. That's not true?
Right, and I think that's a caricature. Okay. You know,
I hope that's a caricature.
There's actually good plans that are proposed often on the right that say maybe it's a better delivery system. And I think people on the left have the same concerns. They say, you know, there's people that need health care. Let's do that. I think what many evangelicals object to mostly about the president's health care plan is probably the HHS mandate, where the government is so big that it's mandating that religious organizations violate their conscience in order to fulfill and, you know, to pay for abortifacients that their employees might
use. An abortifacient would be basically a kind of contraception.
Yeah.
Because in the popular reporting, it's not reported as abortifacient, it's reported as contraception.
Yeah.
But it's contraception that prevents a fertilized egg or some format of that from being implanted or moving ultimately to
explode. Yeah, and the thing that's really, that we really don't like about it is, well, first of all, a company like Hobby Lobby, they cover actually 93% of the contraceptives that, but there's some that they consider abortifacients that violate their conscience. And the thing that we don't like about it is, on the one hand, Christians are saying to businesses and Christian business owners that you need to live out your faith Monday through Friday.
Right.
That it's not just you go to church and then Monday through Friday you're not a Christian.
Difference between freedom, religion,
and so these people are trying to do that. They're
right.
they're really treating their employees well. They're good people, but then the government's saying, well, you can't apply your faith to the business.
Mm-hmm.
So the faith, the same faith that compels a Christian company like Chick-fil-A, like Hobby Lobby, to say, we're going to pay them well, we're going to treat them well, we care about the environment. That same faith also says we can't subsidize what we consider abortion. So that's the thing we object to most.
Mm-hmm.
But I think on the issue of getting health care to people, I think all Christians have to want to be for that, because it's, and essentially, it's a pro-life issue. It's just that the delivery mechanism, good people on both sides disagree what the best mechanism.
The best approach to this. Know. Okay, so our polling, we did polling at mm-hmm. Lifeway Research. Our polling says, and we use the term contraception, because mm-hmm. abortifacient is not what's being reported in the media. Americans are not with Hobby Lobby or the Little Sisters of the Poor. In almost every case, Americans think, no, you should be required to provide contraception.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we use the terminology that's in the media rather than the terminology necessarily that Hobby Lobby and as a Kanesta Woods is using.
Yeah, that's right. It's a Mennonite
case.
Company.
Yeah. And so, but the courts tend to be much more concerned about first freedom, religious liberty, mm-hmm. and, you know, even the arguments seem to be leaning that direction. So, and it appears to me that, and I could be wrong, but because you were in the midst of all this, that I would think that there'd be a much broader, I mean, Catholic support for this if it weren't for the HHS contraception mandate, certainly, and maybe even progressive evangelicals. I think they seem to have lost a lot. So what is the contrary argument that has been made? Why, and I guess I know it, but maybe to share a little bit, why that matters? Why this stake in this ground? There was an attempt at some accommodation, wasn't received well. Why this stake in this ground?
From the administration's perspective?
Well, yeah, I'd love to hear both from the administration and from Michael Ware's perspective, if that doesn't get you in trouble.
Yeah, so what we're seeing is, I think sometimes evangelicals feel like there's a great antagonism towards Christian beliefs and religious liberty. I think there are definitely folks who are strident against those things. There's basically, the more dominant feeling is an apathy and an indifference towards religious liberty. Well, this is, the millennial generation is the first generation to grow up in a culture where you don't learn about what a religious life is through cultural osmosis.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we talk about religious liberty, it doesn't carry a lot of weight by itself in today's society, because we live in a society where folks don't really understand what a religious life is. And I could go through example after example of where that sort of, I think that cultural miscommunication is taking place. The argument from where conflicts come up are when when religious liberty butts head with another valued ideal or goal of the government or of society. And so, right, this contraception mandate is sort of a perfect storm of you have women's rights groups and others that they consider contraception to be an essential health service. And so if exempting not just churches, which were always exempted, but and not just religious organizations like Catholic Charities or Lifeway, exempting Hobby Lobby. Right. And the Catholic lawyers advanced the idea that a Catholic owner of a Taco Bell franchise should be exempted.
Sure.
That's tens of millions of employees. Mm-hmm. And so the question for the administration then is if they believe that contraception is an essential health service like other preventive services like mammograms and other things, should tens of millions of employees, just by the fact of the religious nature of their employer, be denied the access and costs and benefits that are given to other employers?
And what if they're opposed to blood transfusions because they're Jehovah's Witnesses?
That's right. I mean, so this is a very complicated landscape. A lot of people are beginning to put great thought into it. I wrote an article in The Atlantic about the changing face of Christian politics, yeah, where I really ended on this note of this question for the 21st century of how we live together. Mm-hmm. Is central. Russell Moore, mm-hmm, who works with Dan, has contributed greatly on this question. I'll just say from my perspective, I think religious liberty is under considerable pressure. And it is going to be essential that we find an accommodation that that makes sure that religious people and organizations can live out their faith, mm-hmm, for the common good and
I'm
for their conscience.
I'm encouraged to hear you say that. In our recent polling, the majority of Americans, we'll put it on the screen, the majority of Americans thought religious liberty was in decline. The vast majority of Protestant pastors did.
Yep. And, it's a sense, right, and there are two things going on. There's government regulations, which according to outside nonpartisan sources, government regulations have gone up that restrict religious exercise. Sure. Usually they're at the state or local level. So New York City churches being kicked out of public schools.
Zoning issues.
Because
yeah,
of zoning issues. Yeah. There's also this this other thing that is not legal. It's this question of social stigma.
Yeah.
And that's something that can be addressed by our politicians, that maybe there are some political actions that can take place. But really, it's a question of our culture and how we're going to figure out whether we're going to call for the exclusion of everyone who disagrees with us. Mm-hmm. But whether it's Paula Deen or whether it's the head of Mozilla or whether it's whether it's Alec Baldwin,
yeah,
we'd
like to Alec Baldwin.
Right, exactly. Well, that's
but you got to take the ones you don't like too.
End with that, yeah, which is the best witness that evangelical Christians who want to see religious liberty be preserved and that America continue to be the standard bearer for religious freedom is to stand up for the religious freedom of those who don't share your
Absolutely.
Faith. That's
yeah.
what upholds the principle.
That's, right.
That's what
mm-hmm.
keeps the principle separate from culture wars and political issues when we say that this principle is more important than all of
yeah.
all of that constitutionally. This is something that's separate from our day-to-day political battles. This is something that that has to be preserved for everyone. That's going to be important.
When I wrote an article for USA Today called Love Your Neighbor, Even Your Muslim Ones,
mm-hmm.
it was as if I had basically called everyone to worship Baal.
That's right.
And I'm like, this is controversial that you should love your neighbor. And I did it right after the Boston Marathon bombings.
Yeah.
And so I get that. But my neighbor, my Muslim neighbor is a good friend. And as an evangelical believer, I'd like to love him and share the gospel with him.
Yeah.
And you can't hate a people and reach a people at the same time.
That's Absolutely. Right.
Anyway. But we're going to come back from the break, and we're going to talk what kind of launch would you, how do we work together then for the common good? Because I think a lot of people are just not sure, Michael.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of evangelicals aren't sure about the president and whether he wants to and what this future holds. Because I think this president has, my view, this president's a watershed president because he was a person who spoke freely and openly about faith. And even when he evolved, to use this term, on LGBT issues, he spoke of people who differ because of reasons of faith. I don't know that future presidents are going to have that same commentary. So let's talk about how we work together in this landscape, particularly our audience, be mainly evangelical pastors and leaders. We'll be back after this quick break.
What will happen when we have churches that really let the word of Christ dwell in them richly? What will happen when we have teenagers and children who really let the word of Christ dwell in them richly? We think marriages are going to be healthy. We think churches are going to be transformed, that communities are going to be impacted as Christians start to obey the text in their context, in their setting.
You think about the Bible. The Bible is the revelation of God. In fact, John says that it is the revelation of Jesus Christ. If we are to know God, then we must know him through the Bible. Explore the Bible will help us to do that.
So the heart behind Explore the Bible really is Colossians 3, 15 and 16. Let the peace of Christ control your hearts. Verse 16 is let the word of Christ dwell among you richly. So we want to say, hey, churches, church leaders, pastors, do you want a congregation? Do you want a small group? Do you want a Sunday school class filled with people that speak to one another in wisdom, that encourage each other, that admonish one another, that are filled with gratitude in their hearts to God, that they sing and they celebrate the salvation that God's given them? Do you want a group of people like that? Then you have to let the word of Christ dwell among them richly.
The exploration of the Bible, book by book, for groups of all ages, from senior adults, to young adults, to students, to kids of all ages. If everyone is studying the same book, imagine the possibility of revival based upon the study together in community as a group, studying the text in its context. Imagine the possibility of letting the word of Christ dwell in you richly.
Whenever we're squeezed, whenever people in our groups or in our churches are squeezed, whatever's in them is going to come out. If the word of Christ is deeply in them, then that's what's going to come. They're going to speak to one another with wisdom. They're going to sing songs to God. They're going to be filled with gratitude. What's in you is going to come out of you. And so we want to do everything we can to help churches and help small groups and Sunday school classes get the word of Christ deeply, richly in the people.
And we're back. Welcome again to another episode of The Exchange. Glad you're here. Remember, you can join us every Tuesday, 3 p.m. Eastern, and around the world at that time. And of course, as always, all the shows are archived at edstetzer.com. Click on the Exchange link. Okay, so President Obama's a Muslim.
Yep.
And that's just it. All right, we'll just end right there because you've admitted it right here. So, because there's this significant percentage of Americans that believe this, higher percentage of evangelicals. Uh-huh. And it's fascinating to me because, I mean, he sounds like a mainline Protestant with a, you know, kind of an historic African-American traditional church expression. Mm-hmm. But I've had Stephen Mansfield here on the program. He wrote the, was it called The Faith of Barack Obama? I think that's what it was called.
Yep.
And did The Faith of George Bush.
That's right.
I remember hearing, David Brody at CBN saying, this is a conversion testimony.
Yep.
So, you know, I had just Carlos Whitaker on. People watch the show Carlos Whitaker. He's singing with the guy in the East Wing, just nothing but the blood of Jesus. So help us to understand, is President Obama a Muslim? I'm saying that people are going to think they're going to get mad.
Yeah.
But I mean, was it 30% at one point?
It's one-fifth.
One-fifth, was it?
18%.
Okay, and then evangelicals was higher.
Yeah, that's
where
right.
I think I got in the 30s.
Yeah.
All right, so you've seen him in a faith conversation. Tell us.
Yeah, I mean, I've prayed with him, you know, in public settings and private. I've seen him talk very personally with pastors and conversations that have never gone public.
Including Darby's with friend Joel Hunter.
That's right. I've been with him to church. I don't know the man's heart. I know him a lot better than a lot of the people who send out tweets and judge.
Yeah.
His faith. And What's interesting is I think we need to show the same level of concern for our politicians' faith that we do for people that are in community with us. Mm-hmm. So it's really odd to me for pastors to take a pastoral approach with people who maybe aren't all the way there yet on all the issues that they deem to be a part of orthodoxy. with people in their church, and yet they're very quick to sort of cast aside this man who's a human being. The president gave a speech at the National Prayer Breakfast in 2011 where he actually spoke very personally about how much sort of the questions about his faith have challenged him and his family. Yeah. And he said that the way that he responded to those was by reminding himself that he of Jesus's command to seek the kingdom first. And so that was touching to me, and I think it's a part of the responsibility we have with Christians to lift people up and encourage them in their faith. Good. If he claims to be a Christian, mm-hmm. then let's which I believe he is, but by
right.
the way,
right.
Then let's encourage him in that and be in support of him. That's why the Easter prayer breakfast is such a beautiful thing, when you have folks from across the Christian church in America coming together and praying with the president mm-hmm. in the East Room of the
and
White
the
House.
And the most recent, his Easter message this year was particularly resurrection focused.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, a pastor, after the first Easter prayer breakfast the president did, and he did them every year except for his first year because he had just gotten into yeah. office and hadn't figured out what traditions he wanted to institute, walked out and said that was a better presentation of the gospel than I've heard in some churches I've been to. And you know, that's something to uphold. You don't have to, if you don't want to affirm the man, don't affirm the man. But I think that the church, in the time when the Christian faith is being marginalized in our culture, has missed some real opportunities to point out that this president, who everyone considers to be an intellectual, bright, everything that this culture has disassociated from Christendom, actually claims to serve Jesus Christ.
Now the tweet, by the way, was sent by a friend of mine. So but it became very controversial. But I do.
Oh, and there are many. I wasn't speaking about any.
Okay, yeah. But we know who I'm talking about. But when you look at that, I think part of what people would say is, okay, if this man's a Christian, for example, it's the first White House to celebrate the Festival of Lights. The Hindu traditions are, and so it's basically.
But,
so
President, Easter, but I mean, just so President Bush actually started to celebrate Ramadan in
right,
the White
right,
House.
Right, right, right.
So it's not.
But it's not. Others have done that, right? Yeah. And President Bush got a lot of evangelicals excited when he said praying to the same God and mm-hmm. all that sort of stuff. So I'm not looking for my president as my pastor.
Right. Yeah.
But how would. Yeah, and I'm about to say it's flippantly, like I'm trying to put you on the spot, but how do you respond to someone who says, but this action, is it basically comes to different conclusions? So if this is Christian and there are certain things we sort of expect to go along with Christian beliefs, how do we respond?
Well, I think you send out rebukes. You activate politically in opposition to that which you think is which you think is does not align with your beliefs. But I tell you, I think it's a very heavy thing to call someone a liar.
Yeah. And I would just
when they say that they're a Christian. Reminds me, I think it's Luke, when the disciples are asking, saying, someone's performing these miracles in your name, but we don't really know him. He's kind of, and Jesus says, leave him alone.
Yeah.
and that's a very similar, I think we need to bring that perspective to how we treat our
public
leaders.
And I think it's embarrassing that a lot of the people who are the promoters of the idea that he's a secret Muslim are evangelicals. And I hope that whether you agree or disagree with the president, and I don't think it's secret, I disagree with the president on a lot of things, that is ridiculous and unhelpful, and it makes us look nuts.
Just the last thing I'll say, which is right, there were liberal Protestants who put President Bush's faith into question when he was governor of Texas over executions.
Yeah.
And so there's this thing, we want faith to be a part of our political discussions because it's part of what drives people. But it's very important to keep it focused on issues, I think, because...
Maybe we should go the UK way. They don't talk about it.
Well, and that's
until
a whole...
David Cameron, like
last week. That's exactly right.
Now it's a Christian
right.
country.
And so David Cameron declared UK a Christian country.
Last week.
And the New York Times printed this story based on a letter signed by 56 playwrights and comedians to say that there was a national outcry against it. I'm David Cameron actually... mentioned Alpha specifically in an Easter message he gave.
Alpha, by the way, is the largest evangelism program. It's out of Holy Trinity Brompton, largest evangelism program in the world. People might not.
It's not popular in the States.
You guys use Alpha at your church.
That's right.
Right, but it's not common in the States like it is in the UK.
Yeah.
Nikki Gumbel, those guys. Okay, we got to move to comment.
Absolutely.
But you're here, worth the conversation. Okay, so activist faith. Ethics Religious Commission, a very conservative denomination, and yet seeking to find some common ground, for example, on immigration. And you and I are signers of the Evangelical Immigration Table, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you a signer of
yeah.
that? Okay,
yeah.
Good. I thought so. So we're, I mean, there's an area of common ground. How do you, activist faith, how does the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission seek to work with an administration that you oppose on some things, mm-hmm. and there are some things in common?
Well, I think you look for ways that you can work together, and mm-hmm. I think there's biblical precedence for that. I think, you know, you see people like Joseph and Daniel and others working with administrations they may not have agreed with. Not that I'm comparing the president to those guys.
I was going to go there,
guys.
I could see the angry tweets. Right.
But I think we...
That's
part of being faithful. But I think when you... I think if evangelicals could separate themselves from looking from election to election, but just trying to be faithful.
Yeah.
And so my boss, Russell Moore... even though he disagrees with the president on many things, he's respected by the president because he knows, you know, where he stands. But he's not out there trying to bash him unnecessarily and try to do all these things. And I think, you know, if you're first a Christian, and then wherever you land on the issues, rather than the other way around, I think you'll look for ways to find common ground. I think of religious freedom. President Clinton signed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
That's right.
Which is a very great piece of legislation.
Can I just say that historically, liberals have been better on religious liberty than conservatives.
Absolutely.
Particularly at the court level.
Mm-hmm. That's
it's,
right.
It's liberals who tend to be the ones who place religious liberty at a higher level.
Yeah.
And I think people often don't realize that. Conservatives then say, well, the government can legislate those things. Liberals then say, no, it's an absolute right.
Yeah.
And so it's an important distinction.
Well, if we really care about human flourishing, we care about our communities. We're going to try to work with people where we can. And people are doing this every day on a local level without thinking about it. You know, if you're a pastor of a church, you're working with a lot of organizations to help feed the poor, for instance. You know, there's organizations that you may not unite with on what the gospel means, but when it comes to delivering services to the poor and things, you're united. So on a national level, we do that. But I think the way to do that is to respect those in authority, even if we don't agree with them, like Peter called the first century church to do. You know, even though you're strangers and foreigners, respect those in authority, honor the king. Paul told Timothy to pray for our leaders,
right.
Pray that they, you know, give us space to practice our faith. And so, and like Michael said, and I agree with him, if you look at the president not as a sort of avatar to attack or a position, but as an actual man who, a human being, created in the image of God, and that way you'll pray for him, oppose him vigorously where you do, but then find ways to work with him.
And it's but opposing vigorously, I think, is helpful language. I think part of the challenge is how do we do that in a civil way?
Yeah.
And I've been part of a group that Senator Danforth and some congressmen Republicans and faith values, and we've had, you know, so I go to lunch, and Catherine Jefferts Schori would be there, and from the Episcopal Church, and Mark Williams from the Church of God Cleveland, and we all meet. But it almost seems like a bit of a, is there even a point to this? Because you don't win elections by being civil. You win elections by demonizing your opponent. So how do Christians speak into this?
Well, I think you look at what Peter said to the first century church, 1 Peter 3:15. You know, we know the first part of that verse very well, have an answer for every man. And we're pretty good at that.
Yeah, I didn't see how you were going to get there from that. So there's more to that verse?
The second part of that is with gentleness
and respect.
And respect.
It's okay.
And we have this false dichotomy as evangelicals that you can't have courage and civility. You can't hold that tension. We say, well, and I've gotten a tag. You know, if you're civil to people you disagree with, oh, you're caving in.
Yeah, I'm going to get a tag for having you, not you. But I'm going to get complaints over that just for having a conversation.
And we can do both. And the reason we can do both is because our hope is not in the next election and the next leader, but our hope is in Christ. Mm-hmm. And so all we are asked to do is to be faithful. And so we don't have to have the sort of panicked, you know, fear-based activism, but we do it because we love people, we love our communities, and we seek to see humans flourish.
And if your ultimate goal is political victory. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to fall into those traps of mm-hmm. engaging in politics the way that the world does. Mm-hmm. If your ultimate goal is faithfulness, it simplifies a lot of those questions mm-hmm. in ways that are helpful. And the other thing is that when Christians see when others see Christians engaging in politics as Christians, it's a beautiful witness that our faith just isn't something covering up a political agenda. Our faith isn't just something that we carry in as a weapon in the public discourse. Our faith is at the very core of who we are, and people recognize that when people see Russell Moore being willing to be in a room with a president on immigration reform, a president that he vigorously disagrees with on other issues. People see that and say, huh, there's something more than politics to that guy. He's in this for something else. Mm-hmm. And that's in the 21st century, that's going to be, that's the opportunity that Christians mm-hmm. have to offer a countercultural vision of engagement in the world and loving our neighbor.
I think the thing we forget as Christians is that we separate our political activism from our Christian life. So we talk about being kind and loving, and we are. But then it's for some reason when we get on Facebook or Twitter, we do. It's almost like it's okay for us to use language and rhetoric that is really sinful, that is really bad. I mean, if you said the things about, you know, a family, well, maybe if you have family members you don't agree with, but the things you say about the president or tweet or write about someone in your church, I mean, as pastors, we would consider that's sin,
yeah,
gossip, and
sure,
we'd not like that.
Yeah.
But for some reason, we project this onto our leaders. Maybe it's because we listen too much talk radio, maybe because we're just, but we really need to take our Christian faith into that arena and know that God cares not just about what we say, but how we say it.
It's a good word.
You know, the tone that we use.
Yeah, it's a good word. Gentlemen, thank you for taking the time to have the conversation with me. And I agree with you. I think together we've got to ask questions. What can we do? Mm-hmm. And I hope the pastors and church leaders watching will ask the question, what can we do to have a faithful presence in our communities, to work for the good of the city? A passage from Jeremiah you quoted, to really value human flourishing, to join hands as co-belligerents, you know, co-battlers, yeah, against poverty, against the exploitation of women and children, you know, in pornography, for example, you know, so many things that we can do. And I do hope that you'll join with me in praying for the president and praying for gentlemen like these who are helping to work together for the common good. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange. Again, every Tuesday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, and whatever that is equivalent to where you live. And as always, at itsdetcher.com, click on the Exchange link in the upper right-hand corner. Thanks for joining us today.